All right, good morning, everyone. It's time for Bid Nerds, your daily nerd out on the most interesting cars of the day on all the automotive enthusiast auction sites. My name is John Polnick, and along with my partner, Michael D., we're coming to you live from San Francisco. That is correct. We are both in one place for a change. We promise we're not going to talk about the weather because this is the show where we nerd out on the most interesting cars of the day. So, hey, what's going on, Michael D.? I like your hat.
Hey, right? Okay. Yeah, I got a nice hat. You know what? Yesterday we went down to Santa Cruz and filmed, or not filmed, I keep saying filmed, but anyway, right. We did a podcast, the DWA podcast with Lane Skelton and Warren Madsen. And dude, that was awesome. Like they were, they're the nicest effing guys you'd ever meet. And they got this really cool studio at the old Wrigley building. Which is way bigger. It's kind of like you go in a little cave and then you're in like this massive warehouse. It's huge, huge place. But they got this cool little studio and you've been there before, but that was my first time and I just had a blast. We rolled like over two hours of podcasting.
Right.
You and I couldn't shut up because we were just talking about all our favorite stuff. It was very Porsche heavy. So anyways, good stuff, man. I thank you guys. We had a blast. That was really fun. So I'm kind of still buzzing from that. That was really fun.
I think we were the first guests to be in the studio since they came back to the studio. They've been doing Zoom, podcasts for the last few years.
Right.
Or not years, but, for the several months. And so they were back to their studio, and it was kind of cool to be have the honor of being the first guests, even though we stunk up the joint. So sorry about that,
they
guys.
Said they've had the studio for 2 years, and then we're their first guests in studio since COVID.
That's what it said, yeah.
Which is like 18 months. I mean, it's like they only got to use the studio for a short period of the time. So anyway, yeah, we were honored to be back, and it's a really cool space. As you and I are jonesing or kind of green for our own little, remember the Dura-Die studio in the grade 8, right? The G8, is that what you call it?
The 18B.
18B.
The Arts District of Las Vegas. I don't know if you're allowed back in Las Vegas if you don't know that.
That was such a cool space. As we're jonesing to get our own brick and mortar, it was really cool to be guests in their place. So anyway, really fun stuff. That I'm supposed to drop tomorrow, so look for us. Guests of the DWA podcast tomorrow, Bid Nerds.
That is correct. All right, guys. Well, so what we do on this channel is if you've never been here before, we select the most interesting cars of the day from all the automotive enthusiast auction sites. So we dig through Bring a Trailer, we dig through P Car Market, we dig through Rad for Sale and Cars and Bids. We find the most interesting cars, we bring those up, we have a chat about each one of those cars. These are all cars that will have an auction that's going to end today. They're individual auctions. The hammer is going to hit the sound block within hours of this program being live, and we make guesses, we make predictions as to what we think these cars will actually sell for when the hammer hits the sound block, and that's where we really prove that we don't know what we're doing. So we always start out every episode by going over yesterday's predictions and proving that we're a couple of idiots, and yesterday was no different than any other day. Michael Deeb, we're not used to filming together, so this is fun, but we need to be careful with the table here because some of the stuff is unstable. So for those of you who are listening, you can't tell, but the camera might be shaking every time Deeb makes a point.
Yeah.
It's because he makes such a big point that he hits the table and the whole thing shakes and might fall over.
I've got my elbows on the soundboard, which used to be like a desk. And when we first moved in here, this was also the dining room table.
Oh yeah, nice.
You know what I mean? I'll have to refrain. JP, I don't know what to do with my hands.
Just don't hit the desk. You can touch stuff, but when you're like,
nobody should let me touch stuff.
Don't touch anything. Ooh.
Good day yesterday. We're actually pretty even. I won 3 the day before. You won 3 yesterday. So
okay.
We're kind of neck and neck this week. What did we start with? Was it the 2010 Carrera or the Touring?
Let's go with the Carrera, since that's kind of the car in the thumbnail from yesterday.
P Car Market had a 2010 Porsche Carrera. So what we're looking at in 2010 is a 997.2, but as it's a Carrera and not an S, this is just the base car. However, this was a low mile car, if I remember correctly. It's speed yellow with 18,000 miles. It's got the really cool adaptive sports seats that I cannot say enough nice things about. I think those are the best seats in the car business. And then we're also looking at a manual transmission and the factory aero kit, which makes this car super desirable. It's kind of a poor man's GT3 because you get a fantastic driving car, sort of GT3-esque looks, and yet you still have maybe the reliability or the economy of a base Carrera. So super nice car. We have, it's been duly noted, especially by you, that how few .2 997.2 cars were made because of the financial challenges of that era coming out of you know, sort of the recession and the global economy falling flat at the very end of 2008. So as we rolled into 2009 and 2010, Porsche wasn't exactly producing a lot of sports cars because there wasn't a big market for them. Now, as we look back in time, where do you go to find a 997.2? They just aren't out there. The market's hot. There's fewer of them in the marketplace. And manuals, which were not the preferred choice at the dealership, are harder and harder to find. So these cars are bringing a premium. With all that in mind, JP, I really undergot this one.
I was surprised that you missed this one so big. When you made your bid, I'm like,
geez, it was just been doing the show? $40,000 when we're looking at it. And sometimes you just look at the P car, they do find market value, but sometimes it doesn't show up until the very end. And so we're looking at this thing, and I just read the room wrong. So I said $59,000, and I'll take this one right on the nose. You said $75,000, and the car sold for $71,000. So, you know, we're looking at a car that's got, like, say, sub, you know, 25,000 miles. It is going to bring, you know, we're looking at, that's like 75, 80% of original MSRP. I mean, that's a strong number for a car that is, Jesus, JP, that's an 11, 12-year-old model.
Yeah, and I've seen .2 cabs with a manual. So cars without aero kits and without sport chrono and all that stuff go for mid-50s. Right. So you get a coupe with aero and you know, flashy color like this, and 18,000 miles. It's at 71 grand. This isn't a bargain. But that's a lot of car for 70. I mean, yeah. For at least right in today's market, it's crazy. This, you know, a year ago, this car would have struggled to make 59.
I'm still stuck with sort of the dealership mentality. I'll admit that, like, you know, I expect people to pay a premium for an S or a GTS. Mm-hmm. But when you see a base Carrera that's a manual with, like, a couple of cool options brings such a strong money, you realize it's the whole market at large, and that's what's going on here. So anyway,
well, sure, an S or a GTS would absolutely bring a premium, but it would be in the 100. Yeah.
Right, and it was over 100. Yeah, it was on P car market. Remember, it was that white one that had all the really nice stuff. That car was as close to a GT3 as you could find. It had the suede interior and the knockoff wheels. I mean, it was like an 11, I think. It was a really cool car. Anyways, strong number. I think everybody won on that one except me. So P-Car did well, the consignor did well, the buyer did well, and you won the lot. So F all you guys. BAT had a 2010 BMW 328i Touring. So what we're looking at here is a car with the M Sport package, the beautiful cobalt blue paint job, manual transmission, aluminum inlay on the black leather interior, and then pretty low miles. I mean, actually, it was like 70,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
But it's rear-wheel drive, it's a normally aspirated engine, and we just don't see wagons, sport package, manuals all kind of come together and make a really neat used car. So I said 26 grand, and then you took the over, and I say this time and time again, when you bet the over, I know I'm in trouble. You said $27,000. Our car embarrassed both of us. It brought $38,000. JP, I'm guessing the MSRP on this car was probably just under or right around 50 grand. So $38,000 again for an 11 or 12 year old used BMW wagon with closer to 100,000 miles than 50,000 miles. What is going on?
Obviously everyone says that the market is kind of is crazy hot, and that's obvious. But I think above and beyond that is that cars aren't made like this anymore.
Sure.
Everything, you know, if you're not getting a super sports car, I mean, that's why Porsches are such a big deal, is because they still make GT3s and GTSs, and even their base model sports cars are genuine sports cars. No other manufacturer is really making anything that anyone wants anymore. I mean, you cannot go into a BMW dealership and say, "Yeah, I'd like a you know, fairly decent size engine, a 3-liter V or straight six.
Yeah.
I don't want it to have turbos on it, and I want it to have three pedals." They're gonna be like, get out of here! What are you? This is some kind of. They're gonna think you're, you know, some kind of joke TV show or whatever. They're being punked. Nobody is asking for this car anymore.
Right.
Yet there's a huge, huge audience, or rather market, for it. And the reason why people aren't asking for it is they know they'll be ridiculed if they go into a dealership and ask for something like this. The car dealers just don't freaking care about us. They just don't. All they want to do is move as many boxes with as few things that they... I mean, it's... I don't know. I'm going off on this. This is the last of a breed. They haven't made a car. What year is this? 2010?
Yeah,
it's the end of an era. This is the end of... 2011, I believe, they had the smaller engine with the turbos in the 328.
Four banger.
Yeah,
turbo.
So this is it. That's it. It's over 10 years that they've made anything like this, and they're never, ever, ever going to make something like this again.
Yeah.
Especially from BMW, because BMW has completely lost their way.
So as wild as $38,000, this car could be well bought, because if this guy decides to hang on to it for a while, which he easily could, this guy could put 70,000 miles on that car and still own it, you know, 5-6 years from now with 140,000 miles, and it'll still be a good car.
Heck, this thing could have, like, I mean, the 328 powertrain, the naturally aspirated straight six like that, that thing could, I've seen them with 300,000 miles all day. I mean, you could drive this thing forever and then just rebuild it and keep driving it. I mean, it really is.
Eligible for the last car you ever buy.
Yeah. I mean, when we were hanging out with Warren yesterday, he had his old E30 325 with 300,000 miles on it. I mean, this is the last BMW that harkens to that age of when BMW meant something. Yeah. Now BMW is just, I mean, honestly, between you and me, Deep, BMW and Hyundai.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any difference at all when it comes to? I mean,
I'm totally serious.
Like, are you any more likely to turn your head when a new BMW goes by than you would if a new Hyundai went by? I don't think either one of them are basically invisible to me at this point.
I'll be the first, and I'm sure I'm not the only. The new 3 Series grille is offensive. Like, what do you take us for? It's ugly, and everybody knows it's ugly, but you're trying so hard to look different that you're just like, it's just shaking my head. It really is.
It's repugnant. It is repugnant. It's just...
I don't know how to spell that, but that's a good analogy. It's repugnant.
Yeah,
I think
BMW
there's a G
is...
G and an N, right?
Yeah. Repugnant. I think BMW is the worst car maker on the planet right now. Really? Not because necessarily they're... Because they do still make, you know, M cars and stuff like that, and that's pretty cool. But because they've just so blatantly and with intent kicked enthusiasts in the mouth. They just said, screw you. No, screw you. We are way more interested in soccer moms and Karens than we are enthusiasts.
They used to be the ultimate driving machine. Yeah. It seemed like it was an engineer-driven company. And what the products that are rolling out and the diversification of what used to be a really pure sort of boutique luxury brand, it's like the bean counters have taken over the asylum. And we as enthusiasts are like, what the F, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
All right, JP. So let's jump away from that car.
Before we get too ticked off, this gets kind of too negative here, we really kind of
flipped the script on cars and bids. 2002 Honda Insight, one of the early hybrid cars. This is a 1 liter, three cylinder hybrid, front wheel drive, manual transmission with just a smidge under 100,000 miles. It was here in the Bay Area. And it was sort of that like sterling gray, kind of, you know, medium gray metallic with a cloth interior, not even a back seat, but a really small car. And it really, was it ahead of its time? Did it just not make it over? Because clearly the Toyota Prius that came right after it was a massive, massive, not only a commercial success, but largely responsible for a paradigm shift in the American consumer, I would say, because as the proliferation of success happened for Toyota and the Prius, because Toyota eventually hybrided every model they had based on the success of the Prius, the American consciousness really accepted hybrids as alternative transportation or responsible transportation, as a lot of those smug mother effers, you know, clearly gave us, you know, waved some toot at us because of that car. Honda Insight will never be associated with any of those conversations, which is weird, because it was right there, but it just didn't click. So here's this nicely preserved model that was on Doug DeMiro's site. I think that's the wrong site for that car, but I don't know that BAT would accept it, and it sure wasn't going to get land on P car. So where would you go with this car? Maybe that is the right thing. I said $6,000. You went over at $7,500. Our car barely got two more bids and closed and sold at $4,700 yesterday on Doug DeMiro's Cars and Bid site. I won it, but I mean, clearly that auction didn't go anywhere. It was less than $5,000 for that car. Is that fair value? Is the insight more significant than that? Or like, is it nobody cares?
I think it's undervalued. I don't think anyone's paying much more for that. There is a niche market, niche people want this car. But, you know, we discussed this yesterday on the show that, you know, the Prius's success was because, or came from the fact that it wasn't like any other car in how it looked and how it drove. You know, they didn't make a manual Prius, clearly. No. This is a manual car, and it's also only a two-seater, so it really was built for... It was before its time, and it was for a certain type of person that really didn't exist yet. I mean, someone who bought this still wanted to row through the gears, so they were still trying to make this like a car, like a traditional car. And the Prius, you know, we used to play a game when we did, I did a lot of work for Volkswagen at the time, and their, you know, the TDI was the big competitor to the Prius. For people who actually wanted to drive. And so we would go on these tours where we would take a Prius and a TDI, before TDI was a dirty word. And we would drive all over the country and go on these press events where we would show up to a dealership and we'd have a bunch of people out there. And we used to play this game where we would get people, we'd give them a prize. You know, we'd line up like 5 or 10 people and say, how quickly can you get a Prius to move? Like, from dead stop, like, no key, right? So you're outside of the car, get in the car. How long will it take you to actually make the car go in any direction, forward or reverse, doesn't matter. Get the car to move at all. The car was so different from any other car that anyone had ever driven at the time that people would get in that thing, and some people gave up. Yep. Like, people could not get the car...
Engaged.
Yeah. How do you put it in drive? How do you, because it had that U-shaped, like, on the dashboard.
It's like Jaguar's J-gate on the dash.
Yeah, it was just the weirdest non-intuitive thing. And now a lot of cars have buttons and gizmos and stuff like that that aren't traditional, because there's really, you know. So this Insight, it was too much like a normal car. It was really more like a CRX than it was anything else. Right. It just, didn't have any power, and it didn't have any room. You know, the Prius was the perfect car at the perfect time, with four doors, a hatchback, and it was weird looking. So everyone that saw it knew exactly what it was, and you could drive around with your pinkies off the steering wheel and your nose in the air and just, you know, virtue signal to everyone. I actually think this Insight is a terribly good car if you did actually want a, you know, great fuel economy car. The great thing that, I mean, this car, I'd rather drive this than probably almost anything electric, because at least this hybrid, you can go and fuel it up and
I just think there's maybe
the gears.
Like, you and I as car people, we talk about cars that we'd like to have in our own personal collection, and by and large, almost every one of those cars is a car we're either going to go out and drive on a back road, or in a lot of cases might be something we could take to the lake or out in the desert because of Vegas or, you know, the country up in Washington and stuff. But I think there's a third type of car collector that might like to have some sort of historically significant cars. And if you're one of those people, putting away a Honda Insight or putting away the first Tesla Roadster, these are cars that, if you're speculating, could be worth big money someday. The Insight, maybe not, but it is interesting that it was the first, you know, really sort of one of the first of its kind to arrive, even if the Prius was the one that stole the show. So it'd be interesting to see what the future holds for these. But who knows? We, as young as we are, we may not live to see the day a Honda Insight's worth anything more than $4,700.
It's hard to speculate, you know, will any car from the mid-aughts or later ever have a chance to be a classic? I mean, in 20 years, I mean, the cars that we all love right now are 80s and 90s cars. So those cars are 20, 30 years old or more. You know, in 20 or 30 years, who's going to have a collector car?
Yeah.
I mean, Elon Musk said it, you know, almost 10 years ago. He said in 20 years, owning a car will be like owning a horse. You know, it's only for a very, very, very niche group of people. You know,
put
so
on that list.
You know, as right, but we're all gonna die. You know, 20 years, many of us aren't going to be around. Right. And so the people who are, if you say, okay, well, we talked about this on DWA yesterday. What drives the collector market? It's guys in their 40s and 50s with disposable income buying what they wanted when they were in their
20s. And then setting the trend.
And then setting the trend, right? So here it is. If you're gonna look at 20 years from now, who's gonna be clamoring for you know, a BRZ or something like that that they wanted, or a, you know, or a new 911. In 20 years, will you be able to? Will you be allowed to drive something like a 911, a 20-year-old or 30-year-old 911, on the road at all?
Right.
And my answer is no, you won't. I can. I'm 100% positive that that's done. There may be areas and places that you can, but unless those cars can be adapted to intake, you know, what is it, autonomous type functionality, where you can drive within certain areas, and then the car goes onto a grid and drives itself. Unless the car is capable of that, the car isn't going to be allowed in any kind of urban setting. There's no way.
So then
way.
Do you think, and I think we're getting way off topic, but do you think there'll be a proliferation of a place like Spring Mountain, where it's kind of a country club for car enthusiasts, where you could keep your car, like say if for some reason you and I mm-hmm. had a couple of kids and our kids were like, oh, I really love cars because they were so important to daddy, that kid in 20 years from now could belong to the country club and take one car out every once in a while and go do some hot laps? Like, do you think?
The answer is no.
You don't
because,
think so?
Yeah, I don't think so. Because, I mean, think about it right now. If Elon Musk said, you know, it's going to be like owning a horse, is there a proliferation of horse tracks right now?
But people have ranches where they can go ride them up in the hills.
Of course they do, but there's no proliferation. But that the amount of those is becoming fewer and fewer, not more and more.
That's true.
And you know, yes, there will be racetracks. Yes, there will be places where you can drive these old antiques and stuff like that. Rural areas, places that are far away, you know, farmland or country roads and stuff like that. Places where the grid isn't as robust and autonomous vehicles can't connect as well, or long distances. But like, if you're in if you want to cross the country in a car, you know, you're going to be in some kind of box, and you're going to be next to all the big, huge autonomous trucks that are shipping stuff across the freeways. You know, the truck stops are going to be a different animal. I've said it before, I think the last bastion of automotive enthusiasm will be off-road vehicles. So if you want a true long-term...
All of Mad Max, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's more like... it's more like, you know, those Land Cruisers and Jeeps and maybe this Bronco that's coming out, you know. That has the highest potential for being something that I think could be long-term collectible as a new car now.
Yeah.
Because that's something that 25 years from now, you'll be able to drive that new Bronco.
I think that's a great take. I could totally see, you know, the sort of off-road, overland climbers. Still having fun with their vehicles because they're not in anybody's way, right?
Places that aren't on the grid.
Nobody's going to tell them they can't do it because they're really not disrupting anything.
Yeah, the onus will be environment and safety. You know, if you don't care, you must hate children if you want to drive that old car.
Right.
Because the potential for killing someone's kid or grandmother is so high. You know, why wouldn't you want your car to be autonomously driven by a computer that makes no mistakes? I mean, that is here now. They could do it. The only reason they're not is because they, you know, literally the technology is there to create, like, we're in the Bay Area right now. We're in San Francisco, right? It'd be very easy for the computer to say, okay, here's this 20 block or 100 block or 1,000 block area where any car in this zone has to be on the autonomous grid. And you drive into that, and then the computer takes over and drives you wherever you want to go. The only reason they don't do that yet is because there are ethical questions yet to be answered, and those questions won't be answered until there are accidents.
Yeah.
You know, a computer can't make a value-based decision. The computer can only do what someone programs it
possible
to do.
Possible or not possible. Yeah.
So in a, you know, there's still, accidents are still possible in an autonomous grid, right? If you've got a bunch of cars that are driving on a grid and the computers are driving around, and I don't know, let's say, you know, one of these big radio towers, you know, the metal fatigue fails, right? Yeah. And it comes toppling down and it's going to crash in front of a road, right? Now all these computers have to make decisions. They're going to be able to say, all right, this car goes this way, this car goes this way, this one's going to hit a school bus, this one's going to hit the wall. The computer can decide. It has the capability to say, all right, this car is going in this direction. If we go left, we'll kill the driver. If the car goes right, we'll kill a bus full of kids, right?
Yeah.
The computer can make the decision and execute the move. If it comes down to, in a weird scenario, which there are billions of potential scenarios like this, right? Where it comes down, there are only two possible things that can happen within the amount of time. kill the driver, kill the kids, right? Okay, well, most people say, well, of course, you just kill the driver, right? Yeah. Well, what if that driver paid a fee? What if that driver pays an extra $500 a month for the safety fee?
Yeah.
That says, all right, you know, in this situation, I'm always the one that's safe.
Preserved, yeah.
Preserved. Or if, you know, or if the computer says, well, that's Elon Musk driving that car. He employs everyone that made this car, and you know, or whatever. The society has to make those decisions of what's more valuable and what's legal,
like,
and what's not.
It's like donating into the you know, the widows of fallen servicemen, right? You know, and then you get like you, normally you get a little slap on the wrist and you're like, hey, please get home safe.
The obvious answer to these ethical questions is not the obvious answer to everyone. People do not agree on these answers. The computer doesn't care. The computer's like, somebody tell me what you want us to do in this scenario, we'll do it. But if AI has to figure it out, I don't know, you know, I mean, whatever. It's somebody's gonna have to think about this stuff, because that's why they're not doing it. Because imagine if the bus, if the car does wad the driver, saves the kids, family says, all right, Nissan, with your autonomous little box car, we're suing you because you, the computer decided to kill my husband. And so the computer says, oh, whoa, we better not do that. So let's kill the kids. Now the bus full of kids is going, well, the computer, Nissan, TM Corporation said, kill those kids, right? It had the choice. Which one did it choose? Well, Nissan doesn't want to make that decision.
No.
Nissan wants there to be a test case of something like horrible like this happening so that the government or some other entity can say, all right, in this situation, this is what you do. So that they don't have the liability of having to make that that decision.
So Elon Musk just needs to have a Tesla has to kill somebody to figure out what the right scenario is.
Yeah, some electric car is going to have to kill someone in order for this stuff to go forward.
It's already happened.
Yeah, it has. Weird.
There was one scenario I heard, this is just funny, with the autonomy thing, where a tanker truck that had like a polished rig with all its fluids in it turned in front of the autonomous car, and the autonomous car got a reflection instead of a hard thing on its like sonar or whatever it uses. I mean, totally confused the car and boom, you know.
Yeah.
Fireworks. Anyways, all right, moving on. Complete opposite of autonomy. Check this out. JP, Rad for Sale had a 1983 Volkswagen Beetle from the Mexican market, because the last Beetles rolled off the assembly line in the States, or for the States, in 1979. So while Mexico continued to produce the Beetle well into, would you say it was 2004?
2003.
Yeah. This car's from 83. Anyway, 121 miles. Marco from Euro Classics down in San Mateo, San Carlos area here in the Bay Area. He had the car on the lawn at Radwood, right next to us, actually. The Lancia Delta Integrale, I think he had like some sort of 4x4, and then the Beetle was right next to it. So we were two cars away from this car. Put it on Rad for Sale. It wasn't showing very well. It was at like $6,000 with like a couple hours to go. I thought it might go to 12 and fail to sell there. It just, Radwood is, Rad for Sale is still building their audience and sort of their collector base. You were a bit more pragmatic, saying, look, this isn't showing well, as also you said 10,000 and took the under. Our car failed to sell at $8,000. Look, by all accounts, the car is worth more money and the reserve was going to be higher than that. The question is, how realistic or unrealistic is Marco's asking price for a really, really niche car? At 121 miles, nobody's ever going to drive this thing.
Yeah.
And what's the upside on a car? Like, if you're investing 25 or 50 grand on something, you know, semi-ridiculous, you know, in this regard with a Volkswagen Beetle from Mexico, you know, what are you expecting? If you're dropping, JP, let's say you put $30,000 on this car and it sells, the guy who pays 30 grand, where does he think that investment's going to go? Up? Or does he just love it and he wants to preserve it because it's basically an unused Beetle? They made, like, I can't remember the final number, but they made millions of these cars. Not a million, millions of these cars. All the way from, the 1940s all the way up to, you just said, 2003? That's incredible.
I mean, the Nazi war machine was financed by these, right? That was the Ponzi scheme to make
the Beetle. And is this not the most produced car of all time?
It is one of them, for like sure.
The Golf also was one.
This car, that's the thing. This car is just not that rare. I found out what the what the reserve was, and it was not realistic at all. This car is not that rare. If this were a 79, like you mentioned, one of the last U.S. ones that were still had delivered, delivery wrappers and all that kind of stuff. Now you're talking a car that could be six figures. But the fact that this is one of the South American ones, there's gajillions of these out there. And are there any more with wrappers on them like this? Yeah, probably.
Probably.
I mean, yeah. You know, how many? I don't know. Not many, but still, there's probably a bunch of them out there. You know, heck, there could be a warehouse full of them for all we know somewhere where, you know, some drug lord may have like intercepted a truck full of them and just said, all right, Pablo Escobar might have some old soccer stadium filled full of these. You just don't know. They made so many. I still think that the place for this car is a Volkswagen dealership. I mean, Volkswagen, it's just something on the showroom floor that they park it next to an ID4, or they have the new electric bus coming. I mean, you know, Volkswagen is all about the electrification now. That's their whole brand. And so for an individual dealer to have something like this sitting there from the beginning and, you know, juxtaposing that to the new stuff, you know, the people's car to the electric car. You know, whatever. I think, you know, to spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for a prop in your dealership that you're going to have for the next 25 years, that makes sense. It does.
Yeah.
You know?
Or a really expensive prop for like a clothing store down in the Hate.
You put, yeah, right. You put
flowers, sunflower stickers all over it, and then it's really cool. Peace signs and mushrooms and whatnot.
Yeah.
Anyway, neat car. Look, man, it's interesting because I don't think of the Beetle being an 80s car, but it was neat that it was on at Radwood and on Rad for sale. And we're, you know, really wishing those guys come off the stops and get this thing going. So last car, the Intermechanica, which is a brand of company that makes, how do we say this? These are 356 replicas. This one was an A though, right? An A.
356 A replica roadster. Not a speedster.
Yeah, neat car. Tubular chassis, JP, which you said is superior than just adopting a Volkswagen drivetrain. Fiberglass body.
Not drivetrain, but chassis.
Chassis platform. Mm-hmm. Fiberglass body, which is common with a lot of the replicas or most of the replicas.
Mm-hmm.
Volkswagen was like a 1.8 liter motor. 4-speed manual, but really nice details on this car, and we thought highly of it. So I said 45 grand, you took the over at 55 and said you might not even be surprised if it got up to $60,000. Our car sold at 46.5, which was surprisingly closer to my bid. Are you shocked this car didn't bring 50 or more?
I am. Yeah. I'm very shocked, actually. Yeah, on VAT, it's a roadster, it's not a speedster. This is a far more unique 356 replica than you usually see with a nice size engine. I think what, you know, the thing is, I say it all the time, and, you know, maybe I just kind of, I don't know what, I didn't listen to my own advice on this one. The bigger engines in these, the hotter motors bring more money.
So it's more the motor than whether or not it's a speedster, roadster, cabriolet.
That, I think, is why this car was held back. Because, I mean, an 1800 is a pretty good-sized Volkswagen motor. But they make some really cool hopped-up, you know, 2.2 and stuff like that. And, you know, you can really make these engines look like jewelry with a, you know, like my 356 replica has a 911 fan shroud, 13-blade fan, and the dual Webers. And
looks
the
more
engine
authentic
just,
that way, right?
No, honestly, it doesn't at all.
It just
because
looks cool.
Yeah, because the original ones had like a 1600 that looked more like this engine that I have on the screen right now. Just really, and most of them had a single. Well, I don't know, single. You know, carburetor. Some. Yeah, the basic engine in a 356 was a small engine with not a ton of power. You know, the hopped up ones are pretty badass. Now, you know, you look at like a 550 replica on a tube frame.
Yeah.
And a lot of those have like they'll take a Volkswagen engine. They'll even change the valve covers on those to have the Porsche stamped valve covers and the fan shroud and stuff. Yeah. Like, those things look so bitchin', which is very similar to what I have in my 356. But this one with the smaller engine, I am still actually kind of surprised at this result. 46 seems low for one that is as nice as this one is.
Yeah. See, and I would have guessed that had it been a speedster, it would have brought more money rather than... saying.
But speedsters are everywhere. I think.
I know, but it's still the one everybody wants, right? I mean, look at the Cobra replica market, which is the most copied car of all time. There are really, really bad fakes out there.
Sure.
You know, and I think those are garbage. But
people, that's the thing. This isn't a bad fake. In fact, this is the opposite of a bad fake.
Yeah, it's a really
nice one. You know, Porsche people are so about the unique and more rare thing, and a roadster is definitely more rare than a speedster, and it's really not that much different. It just has a better top and roll-up windows. In the A platform, it is kind of peculiar, but yeah, I don't know.
He was on BAT, so it's an interesting result. That's what it's worth. You got three yesterday, I got two. We're all tied up going into Wednesday, and we got kind of some neat cars today. So
all right.
Today, I don't know, a little happier with today's cars than yesterday's cars.
All right, let's get to them. Your daily nerd out on the most interesting cars of the day. If you haven't already, hit that subscribe, like, or notification button. As Michael D. likes to say, smash that notification button. And then, you know what else you can do if you're part of the nerd herd out there? Go out on the platforms that are serving the cars that we'll talk about today. Go into the comments section and say you heard about that car on Bid Nerds. Let the people know. Let the other nerds in the world know that they have found their people, that the Big Nerd Nation is ready to receive them. let everyone know about the Big Nerds on these platforms in the comment section.
That was the compliment we got at Radwood when we were down there. We met a few people who listened to the show that we had not met in person. Mm-hmm. Perfect example, Tom from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And even Lane said it. A few other people said it. They're like, I can't believe it, but I can't not watch your show. Like, I have to watch it every day, which I thought was pretty funny. I wouldn't consider us like, you know, Pepperidge Farm cookies or Pringles, where you once you start, you can't stop, you know? So anyways, really neat. But yeah, if you go tell people that we covered that car, you know, I think that'd be really cool for us to have that dialogue going. That'll help spread the word and keep the lights on. So thank you for doing that.
All right, well, let's get to this 964, because this thing is hot.
It is, but I can't, JP, I can't for the life of me figure out why this one is where it's at. So what we're looking at here is on P-Car Market. This is a 1991 Porsche 964 C4 Coupe with a manual transmission. And the chassis, the motor, has 132,000 kilometers on it. That's 80-something thousand miles. The car is in Vancouver, British Columbia. So it's in Canada. It's high mileage. Four-wheel drive. Then on top of that, this guy's saying it's all modified. They bored out the motor and made it a 3.8 liter. They put some Magnus Walker wheels on there. It's got some tartan seats and a Momo steering wheel. They roof did the suspension for them with some parts that they sourced from those guys. And it looks by all accounts to be a really neat driver that will, in my opinion, never be a collectible because it's no longer original. It's really far away from that, especially once you bore out that block. There's no going back. That motor is always going to be 3.8 or bigger. That's the end of that one. So explain to me, JP, why this car is sitting with 3 hours to go at $100,000. That's over the value of what this car would be if it were a bone stock C4. And most of the time when we see somebody spend money on accessories to make their cars unique, that hurts the value, doesn't enhance it. This listing on P-Car Market is suggesting or implying that they spent $100,000 on modifying that car. I don't think that's accurate. This doesn't look like that. Even if they spent 30 grand to rebuild that motor, or even 40, the rest of the accessories are all stuff you can get on Amazon, and you can make this car for a lot less money than that. So nothing about this particular auction lot makes any sense to my hate to call it intellect, but at least my car knowledge. What in the hell is going on here, JP? Can you explain it?
I think you got to check the mirror, man. You're wearing a DeFascination hat, not a Porsche dealership hat.
Yeah.
I am shocked that you don't see the value on this thing because it is, it's a hot rod. I mean, yeah. when you see a, you know, 71 hot rod with a, you know, 3.6 in it, those go for a shit ton of money. This car when was the 3.8 done? When was all this stuff done? You say it has 138,000 miles on it, which is true, but when was all this work? I mean, we're talking fenders off, engine rebuild, bored out to a 3.8. That is the hot setup. I think this car, the hot rod thing is why this car is bringing so much money.
If it were stock, 2020.
Yeah, oh my God, this is, I mean, what are you talking about? To get a C, look, C4 964s are going for $60,000, $70,000 with 100,000 miles on them. No problem if it's a coupe, right? This car basically is a new engine with more power, with coilovers, with all the right mods. I mean, Magnus wheels, blah, blah, blah. The list goes on. There's nothing on here. I mean, where are you getting Magnus? You have a set of 1552s.
I have these same wheels.
Yeah, you can't get those on Amazon. You're not getting those lights on Amazon.
I'm just saying,
you can sit
at home and order all the accessories and make this car yourself for less money than they're implying that they paid for it.
And how are you going to do it today? You want this car built? You're waiting a year and a half.
That's a very fair take. So if you want one that's done, it's sitting here right now. But time and time again, we see these cars, when somebody does one, it's subjective and it doesn't necessarily have broad appeal. This one at least has tasteful mods because, you know, everybody loves a silver Porsche. I can't think of anybody that'd be like, ooh, barf, it's silver. It looks great. I do really like these wheels. And I'm not saying this car wouldn't be amazing to drive. I'm just surprised it's like zeroed in on a pretty major premium. And usually you don't get your money out of the investment. I don't think this guy is. Let's say he did spend $100,000 on it. And let's say he picked up the car for $60,000 a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't think this car is going to bring $160,000. So he's not going to get his money out of it. But I'm just surprised it's as high as it is. It's not that I don't like it. I just don't understand how this car, being in Canada, is already so high.
I mean, Vancouver is an easy city to get in and out of, which is great.
Fun place to be, too, right?
Look, if this car with 130,000 miles with no mods, a stock one, is still worth $70,000-something, there is no way, if you pay $120,000 for this thing, that you're getting it. There's no way you're building this for $50,000.
Yeah.
And there's no way you're doing it inside of a year or two. I mean, to get that engine, to get the fenders off, all that stuff that they did. I don't know, you know, look, I know you don't go out in your garage and wrench. I certainly hate doing that stuff. So we're at the mercy of dudes that do.
Yeah.
You know, they are booked for a very, very, very long time. This car, the $50,000 premium over a worn out one, you know, because look, you buy one with 138,000 miles, you're going to need a top end rebuild at the very least, and that's probably $10,000-$15,000, and that's before suspension, that's before bearings, it's before all your bushings, before your steering rack, before your differential, before your you want me to keep going? Yeah. I mean, how do you not see the value of this car?
I'll say something nice about it that's in line with what you're trying to do. Like, if this was, so basically your 132,000 kilometers is 82,000 miles. So if you find, which is absolutely out there, if you find an 82,000 mile RSA, that's still $130,000, $140,000 car in today's market. If this car sells for $110,000 or $120,000 or $125,000 or whatever, and you bring it in from Canada and you pay the tax on it, you're still in comfortably under the price of the RS America. And this car will run circles around it. And it'd be more fun to drive, you know. And an RSA is a beautiful car.
I don't even remotely close to agree with you of your assessment of what an RSA would go for. When have we seen an RSA in the last 6 months?
Well, we haven't.
Exactly. So you could get one for $130,000, no way. I think an RSA right now, if an RSA like the one you used to own with 50,000 miles? 50, that's a $200,000 car right now.
I know. Don't rub it in.
I hate to say it, but it's true, right? That car was so dang perfect. Sorry about that. No, I'm bringing up bad memories. Or good ones. I don't know. Look, you had one of the most beautiful cars of all.
Yeah.
I think the idea an RSA 3 to 6 months ago was a $120,000 car. That is not the case anymore. No. And I'm sure we'll be reminded of that, or that will be.
We can't wait to see one come, because we'll be all over it. It'll be really fun to talk about that car, because we both have experience with it. I mean, man, you almost had one, right? Like, it's funny. The ones that get
talk
away.
About, yeah,
the, like, we should, one day we'll have to make a list of our top five cars that got away. You know, I was right there in front of this car and I didn't get it. Anyway, all right. So, JP, I'm going to go. Again, I'm trying to be pragmatic about this car, and my brains and my emotion are not assessing this thing fairly. So I'm just going to say $110,000, because somebody still has to bring it across the border. It will be easy. It's not impossible to do. It qualifies for the United States Department of Traffic, the DOT, 25-year exemption. So this car will be easy to bring across and fun. Coming to Vancouver is a great city. But you still have to pay for it. And so you're in, you know, you're talking about, you're still in this like 120, 125 when it's all said and done with tax and all this other nonsense. So where are you at?
I have a C4993 with 30-something thousand miles on it.
Yeah,
in the same color.
But
I have a 3.8 and it's not a 964. Well, that's exactly my point. That's what I'm getting at, is that in a heartbeat, I would trade this car or my car for this 964. It would take me a nanosecond to hand the guy the keys and get the hell away from there. Before he changes his mind.
Driving the other direction.
You know, to have a 38964 with all these mods recently rebuilt like that, it's just, hello, here you go. So if whoever buys this car, if you want a super low miles 993, let me know. It's not for sale, but for this car, it would be. I'm going to say $120,000.
$120,000. All right. I think you're fair. I think we come in right around this thing.
Yeah.
JP, really quick, because I'm having a problem with it. Why? I don't like these photos at all. I really don't like. There's like a
palette. Oh, the 964?
Yeah, I don't. There's like a palette. There's this like, it's like low light. It's kind of a hazy day. He's filming like in front of the bay or wherever they are in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And it's a light sky, hazy mountains in the background. It's a silver car. And these photos, it just like, it's really hard to tell the condition of the car in these images. Can you explain to our audience that's not watching the show why I don't like them?
Yeah, a lot of them are vertical. It's obviously done on the cell phone. They're just snapshots. I don't hate them per se. Like some of the I just hate vertical photos.
I do too.
But the horizontal ones shooting into the sun with the lens flares are fun. I mean, I'm okay with those photos as long as you also include a batch of cleaner photos, photos that are basically showing you, you know, that are a little less romantic and are just like, here's the coverage of the car. You got to respect they're trying, they're doing the golden hour and everything. So, all right, they gave it a whirl. Not the worst, but this car could definitely have been represented better and would probably bring more money if it had. I don't see if there was a video or not.
I really noticed before, but several parts of the interior have been redone in Alcantara, and the Momo Prototipo is actually a Magnus Walker wheel.
Oh, sweet.
Which is kind of cool. The steering wheel is worth $1,500 to $2,000. So, and closer inspection, it is a neat car. And maybe the value is, not maybe, the value is there.
Am I bringing it around? I don't know.
Yeah, the value is there. I just, I don't know.
Anyway, you know, all right, today's dollars, right?
Here's another one that doesn't make any sense, JP.
Terrible driving video.
Let's go to BAT and look at this 1970. Essentially what it is, it's a 1970 BMW 2800 CS out of Torrance, California, showing 93,000 miles, true mileage unknown. What you're actually getting is an engine swap, right? So this is from, I think, a 635 CSI or something. It's a 3.5 liter inline six. And instead of a four speed manual, it's an adopted, again, a five series BMW, like an E28, five speed manual transmission. They put the sort of prerequisite, the 16 inch Alpina wheels. It's got silver paint. And what color is the interior? It's sort of black sports seats that look a little bit like a CSL. There's really cool steering wheel, five-speed manual, really nice condition, and then everything's been modified, right? So springs and shocks, limited slip differential, it's all there. So what you're looking at now is sort of rebadged to a 3.0 CS. Should be CSI because it's not carbureted. But these cars, we've seen even modified versions of these cars bring over $200,000. The E9 platforms are seriously hot. In fact, Yuri's building one where he paid for the car and initiated the project. And now since he's done that, the market on these is just what you call it, the hockey stick, right? And, you know, it's like it's dead, dead, dead. And all of a sudden it just turns and goes up. This is he's in the right place at the right time. And I think this car is hitting the market at the right time. You could have picked this car up where it was totally bastardized for like $45,000 last year, and now this car is sitting, JP, with 3 hours to go at over $100,000. Where, you know, what's the cap on these things? Look, they're beautiful cars. They're very nice drivers. They're really not sports cars, but they're absolutely GT cars. There's an elegance to them. There's a purposefulness to them. They're totally period correct. I love sort of the twin kidney with the four headlight design that's very screams early BMW. And we don't see cars that have kind of this grace in today's new cars. Everything looks too pretentious with all the lines, what do you say about the Supra? It's got all these
radiuses
everywhere. This car has two or three really pretty radiuses, and then the rest is sort of left alone. Look at that greenhouse where all those windows go down, and it's a real coupe, right? The whole side of the car opens up. I really love these, and this is really neat. And it also makes me sad to cover one like this because even the chopped up one, the least original one that you might find, is still now a six-figure car. And these things are here to stay, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think about the E9?
It's one of the most beautiful cars ever made. Nice. I think it's, you know, for the money, it's like, yeah, they're crazy expensive, but compare it to like an Aston Martin of the era, it has that same kind of look, and that's, what, a million-dollar car or something?
Yeah.
You know, Yeah, it's not a sports car though. So where does this car sit in your garage, and how many other cars do you have to get before this one's one of them? You know, it just depends entirely on the type of enthusiast you are. If you like going to shows and concours and that sort of thing, and just driving around and looking classy, this is your rig. You're rowing through gears, and this thing's just beautiful.
I tell you what, look, if you're in Vegas, JP, and you guys are doing the Overton run, you're taking this car. I mean, this car at 120 miles an hour is elbow out the window and your index finger at 9 o'clock, and you're in total control of this vehicle. And in the sweepers, this thing is absolutely fantastic. If we're going out to Pioneer Saloon and we're going to do the Sandy, which is just total switchbacks, it's bumpy, it's undulating, and it's tight and it's aggressive, you're going to grab a Carrera. You're going to, you know, and that's, and so there is a purpose for this car. It's just not the, like, once you get past sort of 7/10 driving, this car will be handicapped because just the nature of the car, you know. But it doesn't mean it's not a wonderful driving and enjoying car. That inline six sounds absolutely glorious. The five-speed manual in these is wonderful. They're great to shift. In fact, I think it's a Getrag gearbox. I'm not sure about that, but you know, it being a German company, it's one of the two German gearboxes. It's either a ZF or a Getrag by all accounts. So really neat car. They're totally on the move. Ours is sitting at $102,800 on a 19 bids. So there are people watching it. It is a reserve auction, but I'd have to think that that reserve got to be close to 100 and that this thing's going to sell. JP, I think, look, I wouldn't be surprised if this car brings 140 or 150 because if I was making one the way this guy did, mine would look very similar to this. But I'm still kind of taking the under of this. I'm going to go 125,000 and send it to you. But we saw one recently bring over 200 grand. Yuri brought it to our attention post-auction, and you and I were away, so we couldn't cover it.
Where is this one sitting at now? I'm sorry.
It's at $103,000, and it's down in L.A.
Yeah, I'm going to bet the under. I'm going to go $115,000. Really? If it's not original, I think
we're
just
embarrassed today. It might bring a lot more.
I mean, I just don't know. I don't know these, admittedly, nearly well enough, and I'm just going off of the whole fact that it's not original. Even after we just came off that 964, that's not original. This one, and I, you know, couldn't shut up about how much more that one was worth.
Yeah.
I think this, I would assume that this car represents an amazing value because it's not a real one, and you can get the look and performance and all that stuff, and have a car that's maybe a little bit guilt-free. If you buy this and drive the living stink out of it, you're not going to, who cares?
Yeah.
Whereas if you get a real one, you know, you're going to be conscious of what you're doing to a super, super classic, which I don't care, but some people
do. The rear one with a 2.8 inliner six, four-cylinder, and the suspension on this is really squishy, you know, skinny wheels, tiny wheels. The silhouette is there, but the car, the whole presence of the car is not there. I mean, the way this guy put this one together, it's absolutely what I would do to mine. You know, 3.5, 16-inch wheels, sway bars on the whole thing, 5-speed. This is a great driver. So anyway, we'll see how far off the mark we are, and maybe this will help educate the bid nerds on what E9s, what the real value of them will be. And obviously some inspiration for our friend Yuri.
Like we always say, we don't know what we're talking about.
Not on this one. Okay, let's jump over to a car. This one, JP, you know, when we talk about cars from the gray market, we joke that they're made from unobtainium. We're looking at, on BAT, a 1994 Audi RS2 Avant. This was a car that was slightly collabed with Porsche. Porsche lent them the cup wheels for this car. I think they helped with the suspension in some way, very similar to what they did with the E500. I even think that this car came out of the factory where they had built, Porsche had just completed the last 959, and then they had this empty factory with no projects in it. And I believe that's where they assembled these cars. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I think that's what happened. So basically what we're looking at is a car that is a four-door wagon with a 2.2-liter inline five-cylinder that's turbocharged and makes a whopping 300-something horsepower with 300 pound-foot of torque. It's all-wheel drive. It has a six-speed manual, and it literally has Porsche 17-inch cup wheels and Porsche big red brakes. There's some nice little aero adjustments. Particularly pretty is that lower front air dam that's in the front of this car, giving it a face. And this car was never offered in America. So in a two-year run, they made about just under 3,000 of these things, about 2,800 of them. But these cars were only going to people that could afford them. This was by far the most expensive Audi in period. And a car that literally could give a Porsche a run for its money on the Autobahn, because this is a car that could cruise. I mean, like legit cruise at 160 miles an hour if you've had confidence in your tires. But 311 horsepower from a little tiny Quattro Audi was crazy back in the early 90s. And a car that we have, I think, on our shores, always look, if you were an Audi guy, this is one of the holy grail cars. I mean, this is, you look longingly over the pond at what they were driving in Europe. This is really neat. In 1998, Dad and I did the Tour de France Auto in that little Fiat. There was a wealthy Brazilian guy driving a GT40 on that event, and his chase car, his wife and kids were in a Nagaro blue Audi RS2 that was essentially like a brand new car. And I was like, man, that guy's got everything. You know? So it was it pretty neat stuff. I've seen them in person. They're just really neat cars. Look, it's still an Audi. Expect there to be maintenance. Expect there to be little tiny gremlins. But when the car is running, this is about as cool as it gets. And in period, it was almost peerless. So JP, our car, which is brought in a couple years ago, is sitting in Durham, New Hampshire, which I've never heard of. There's 138,000 kilometers on the odometer, which is about 86,000 miles. And the car looks to be in decent condition, but there is one photo that's kind of troubling to me. JP, there's a photo of the motor, like the valve cover gaskets and the intake manifold look like they're made of magnesium, and they have these like calcium spots on it, which suggests to me that the engine got wet somehow and then wasn't dried off properly. Is that what you see when you see the spots like that on the engine, or do you think that's from something different?
Yeah, I mean, it does look just a little dirty, but a detail would fix that up.
Yeah, it's weird that if you have a car this special, you wouldn't handle that. Why wouldn't you take care of that?
It could be stored someplace that might have a little moisture in there, and just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too concerned about that, but it
really?
Is. Okay. That poor seat got a little beat up. But.
Okay, silver's not the most exciting color, but a lot of these cars have two-tone interiors that I detest, so I would totally rock this one because it just has an all-black leather interior. So, JP, clearly I'm a fanboy of some really cool Audis. I love this one. I think this is really cool. I always thought Gary should buy one of these and put it in his collection because of the sort of Porsche connection there. So the 1994 Audi RS2 Avant is sitting at 77,500 with 2 hours to go out of New Hampshire. And it is somewhere on a domestic title. It was brought in 2019. So my bid is, I don't think it's going to quite break 100 grand, but I'm going to say 95,000 bucks. And I would also say, wouldn't be surprised if it broke 100 grand. And if it gets to 95, I think it sells. I think that's got to hit reserve.
I guess I don't get to say anything about the car, but that's all right.
Through you? I'm sorry.
That's okay. I really didn't have a whole lot to say.
You hate Audis anyways.
Kind of hate Audis. There's a gauge, there's a boost meter on the dashboard that does not look factory to me. Has this car had a bunch of engine mods because it's a turbo and all that kind of stuff?
No.
That's, if there's one thing I can't, you know, on an Audi, and an old Audi, you know, everyone just goes and tweaks the living daylights out of their turbos and stuff like that, and that just scares the heck out of me because these are not reliable cars. You know, before I saw that, I would say, I mean, this particular car, I don't know, but the Polar Silver with the cup wheels, I don't like Audis. Yes, I'm that guy, but I will say if I could only have two cars in my garage, this car and a 993 would be a pretty darn cool-ass combination, or this and a 964, you know, like an RSA or something like that, and this.
And it's hard to imagine that this might be the quicker car from a standstill, you know, right, which is crazy.
Well, I mean, for sure, with turbos and 300 horsepower, it's going to blow the doors off a 964 or a 993.
It's the 300 torque that's going to get you, like, off the line and down to the next light.
Yeah.
When the road starts turning curvy, the Porsche will come into its own.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. There's something weird. This engine looks sort of neglected. This picture blown up with the spots on it really disturbs me. And a close-up of that gauge you're talking about, and then you notice how cheap that aftermarket head unit looks in the dash, and it just looks like this car was owned by somebody that didn't have the money to make it nice, or he would have.
Were these cheap for a while? Did they ever get cheap?
Well, I mean, the thing about cars in Europe, like really unique cars like this, is people will drive them to 150, 200,000 miles. So you could have got one for 50, 60 grand if you brought one in, but it would have been ridiculous, like 250,000 kilometers or 300,000 kilometers.
Well, but 50 or 60 grand was never cheap. It's not like it ever became a $5,000 car.
These were never cheap cars. They were just too special, despite, I would not say it's a really limited car. 3,000 units in 2 years. I mean, they must have saturated the market in Europe.
All right, well then, what was your bid?
I don't think it's a $100,000 car. So I went $95,000, and I'll leave it there.
And it's at 70 now, and
77.
Okay, I'll say it gets another $10,000. I'll go 87.
87,000. Yeah. All right, there we go.
Pretty much a guess, because not like we see a whole heck of a lot of those. Yeah, it really would be a great match to a single Porsche of the era, though.
It really would.
And it is really cool to see the Porsche script on the intake manifold.
Yeah, and I love the cup wheels with the big reds is awesome, too. Yeah. I think it's pretty sick. All right, JP, we've done a couple of these, but I just still think they're to me, they're still a really rare car, although we've done three of them in the last 3 months. What we're talking about on Bring a Trailer is a 1993 Land Rover Discovery Camel Trophy car. This one has 118,000 kilometers out of Carthage, Texas. That's just 73,000 miles, even though they claim true mileage unknown. Now, all these are right-hand drive. All of them use a 3.5-liter, a little bit smaller version of the Rover V8. This one, unfortunately, is a 4-speed automatic rather than a manual transmission. But these all went and did these incredible events, including the Camel Trophy itself. And they're just neat to see when they're in the U.S., and I still think they're kind of special. This one looks sort of plain because it's not all kitted out with the livery and all this other stuff, and there's not like a big basket on the top or a winch. It does have a brush guard with some auxiliary lights and a ladder on the back, but otherwise this one looks pretty plain Jane and in fair condition considering what it's done and the mileage that's on it. I don't know why I keep thinking that these are like really expensive trucks, and they're not. Like, to me, I would think a sub 100,000 mile version of an authentic Camel Trophy would be a $25,000 vehicle. But with an automatic transmission and 4 hours to go out of Texas, our car's sitting at just $7,000 on BAT, which is going to get the biggest audience for it. So I'm obviously overvaluing these cars. But what do you like about this one, and where do you think the challenges are for somebody who might consider buying something this unique and this old from Land Rover, which could be a scary proposition, right?
Yeah, you're looking for a headache with this thing. There's nothing to really like on this one.
Because it lacks a stick, right?
Well, one, it lacks a stick. It's right-hand drive. This is a piece of junk. I mean, this one's worn out. Now, if you had a brand spanking new one or whatever, the interior actually looks better than I would have anticipated.
Right.
You know, it's got the full diff lock, which is fantastic. That's a lot different from a regular Disco. That's the thing that, you've got a front and rear true lockers. Yeah. So this thing will crawl over anything.
Right.
And, the simplicity of this vehicle versus, maybe an SE7 or something like that, whereas all the electronic gizmos, they're going to break too. This doesn't have any leather. It's cloth. It's lighter. It's a bummer that it didn't retain its big roof rack, safari rack, and all the livery stuff, and usually the big lights and stuff.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what's going to...
snorkel up the side so it could go
through exactly. And that's what I'm like wondering, was this really a trophy one? Is this a genuine? Or was it like one that didn't... Because it, as beat up as it is, it doesn't look like it ever really did the race. The interior is too nice. So, I don't know. I don't care about this thing. I don't understand why anyone would buy it. Like, race cars have provenance. Oh, this car won a certain race or did this or did that, and that can add value. I don't think that's really the case with this particular lot. So.
Right. So perhaps the last Camel Trophy we cover for a while. With 4 hours and 20 minutes, this car is at $7,000. On lowly 5 bids. JP, I don't see how this car is even going to make it to 12,000 bucks, but that's where my bid is going to come in at. 12 grand to you.
Yeah, I'm going to go 11.
All right, 11 it is. All right. So long, Disco. This isn't even a Disco, right? It's a Disco.
Disco, yeah.
Yeah, a Discovery. All right, last car, and this is an interesting one. On P Car Market out of Roseville, California. Now, Roseville is just on the far side of Sacramento if you're heading towards Tahoe. Is this 1986 Porsche 911 Carrera Coupe with a 5-speed manual. Now, because it's an 86, it still uses the 915 gearbox. People do pay at least a small premium for G50s because they're a little easier to row, even if they're not as fast when you're really getting on it. Our car is black with a beige interior. It's got air conditioning and a Carrera wing, as you'd expect from a Carrera in that period. It does use the 3.2-liter, and it all seems to be there. Our car, its only handicap that I can see, is that it's high mileage. It's 155,000 miles. Again, out of Roseville, California, but it's sitting at just $30,000. Now, last night, the car was at like 14 or 16 grand. This morning, it got up to 20. And now as we're, at the end of the show, it's up to $30,000. But it still has 2 hours to go. you know, is this thing going to make it up to current market value, which is pretty high for 3-2 Carreras, especially the coupes? Or is this one truly going to be held back because of the high mileage, which I would say if the car is clean, if the leather and the dash aren't falling out of this car, who cares if it's got 150,000 miles? Is that fair to say or what?
Yeah, I mean, so number one, the dash is all cracked up, which is a big deal killer for you and I, even though it's, as a Carrera, I think this thing has a long way to go. I mean, P-Car Market and BAT always have late flurries when it comes to Porsches. Why would you bother bidding on this thing at all until the last 5 minutes?
Well, I mean, that's what's happening, right?
Yeah, and that's what's going to happen. So $30,000 is not indicative of what this car will actually bring in a few hours. No, I don't think the miles are gonna hurt it tremendously. I don't know what the maintenance records are, if it's had a top-end rebuild yet or a full rebuild or if it's out of the clutch or when it was last done. I don't know if you saw any of that in the ad. But, I mean, if the car has been up-to-date on maintenance, these are robust engines. They are very reliable. Curious to see if the air conditioning
miles
still
ago,
works.
The engine and transmission were rebuilt, and the catalytic converter has also been gutted for improved exhaust flow. So he took it out. I don't know if it's included with the sale, but there you go. Bilstein Sport Shocks, new CV.
Weird parts. That it has like the mocha carpet in the front. In the boot.
Oh, yeah, that I didn't see.
That's like not the same interior color. That's really weird to me. What is going on there? Have you ever seen one like that?
No, and it's ugly.
Well, yeah, but I don't care that it's ugly. I mean, it is.
I do. But it's
you're strange. The point is that it's like, it's weird because it's like...
I don't think it came from the factory that way, so it's been replaced with like an accessory version. That would be my guess.
Yeah, right?
And then the accessory, the company that makes it, it's like, well, we could do it in a different color and see if people want that.
Yeah, I don't know. That must be it. Maybe it was replaced at some point. That would be a huge flag for me if I were considering this car right up the front. It's like, well, did they change the interior color? Was this the original color and they changed the interior? Or was it just a replacement front carpet? I don't know. But it is really great to see those valve covers. Looks like they've got the turbo 930 valve covers that have the flanges on them, so they, you know, pull air off of it, they cool better. It just looks really clean under this. Looks like the suspension's really clean. So the car is a little rough. It's poorly photographed in a way that actually is kind of helpful because you see all the rock chips and the scratches and stuff. I mean, it's a black car, and living with a black car is not the easiest thing in the world.
The passenger side of the dash is actually really clean, and as you're talking, I'm like looking, you know, for the cracks you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's two big cracks.
Massive ones.
Over the sort of like gauge, you know, thing on the driver's side. And they're just such a deal breaker because you got to remove the windshield to get that dash out. You got to spend big money to get a leather dash if you want it. It's just not an easy job. And it's like a couple
thousand dollar, you know, thing, which isn't the end of the world. No, they do
but
sell
how
those.
Do you want to throw at 150,000 mile driver?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They do make those plastic, they make a form-fit plastic cap now. It's not like the stupid carpet that everybody had. It's like this thing that just pops on there. I actually did that on the Marlboro Targa I had and was shocked how good it looked.
Yeah.
Didn't look great, but at least you could, like, if you're sitting behind the wheel, you're not just going, you know, like, I know you are just like me in that regard. If you're sitting there looking at a crack on the dashboard, it will just tick you off every time you're behind the wheel of the car. You put that cap over it, and it's so like, weird. Out of sight, out of mind.
It's like, it's messes with your OCD, and you're like,
I totally hate this car.
Yeah.
This car, it really bugs me. That stupid Porsche script on the side is so wrong on this thing. The light gray and the white script just looks awful.
Yeah.
I think if they had gone like flat black or satin black, it would have been really
ghosted
cool. Ghosted it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just glaringly not period correct. It's glaringly not right.
The other thing they could have done was gone gold, and I think that would have been better with the tan interior. But
or even better, just don't do it.
Well,
you know, I mean,
that's my thing. I would mess with it.
I mean,
but I did put Carrera script on my M491, and I had to take my turbo rock guards off in order to execute it correctly. I bastardized my car, but that's my car. It's my car.
I mean, it looks good. It looks correct. It was applied correctly, and it was black on your Rubino, which is a good combination. This black with the weird off-color. This car is already black and brown. The wheels are black with, you know, they're Fuchs with the, you know, polished, they're not really polished, but just the brushed aluminum lip, of course. So you've got this different color gray that doesn't match the lip, doesn't match the car. Then you got the white script. There's nothing else that's white on it. You know, yes, gold would have worked. And I think Carrera would have been better than Porsche.
For sure.
And, but this thing's, yeah, just pull that off. It's just going to look so much better.
Yeah.
Here's a little photography tip. All right, we're always talking about photography, right? And, you know, this guy obviously tried to shoot the car during golden hour, which is fine if you're doing it correctly. The problem is where the light is coming from. You look at this photo and look at the wheel wells, right? The inside of the wheel wells are dirty.
Looks like there's a light on in
there. Yeah, because the light is shining directly into the wheel wells and lighting up. If the light, if you shot this car from the other side, there wouldn't be light in the wheel wells and you wouldn't have that extreme gap and it would all just kind of fade in. It would be all black. So you have to either turn the car around to shoot this side of it or just not shoot it. Yeah, I mean, that's what lighting is all about. This car is represented horribly because of how it's shot. And, you know, you can't expect anyone who's not a photographer to know these things.
Right.
So that's why you should spring for the extra money and get someone to photograph the car that does know what they're doing. Where's this car going to land?
JP, it's at 30,100 with an hour and 50 minutes to go. Again, offered out of Roseville, California, near Sacramento. I put $57,000 and I am going to stay with that bid, but you know, this one's really hard to kind of gauge the value on it. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if it went for 45 and I wouldn't be surprised if it went for 65, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think your bid is really good. I think money is being left on the table because the photography is so terrible. Mm-hmm. You combine that with the high miles, you combine that with the dashboard. I think what you have is a car that people won't dig into. When you find out that the engine's been rebuilt, now all of a sudden it's a completely different animal. It's like, oh my gosh, a rebuilt engine that, you know, somebody spent $25,000, $30,000. This thing you can drive to the end of time, guilt-free, this should easily be a $60,000 Carrera Coupe. But I think people are going to fail to get to that information. It's just, there are too many check marks against it.
It's in the last paragraph.
Yeah, they should have led with that. It should have been, you know, Carrera with engine rebuild, you know, just the other day, basically. Boy, this guy is going to lose money for not getting proper photos because it's just no one's going to get there. 57 grand is absolutely what it's worth, maybe 60. But I'm going to bet the under because I think people this is going to be one of those rare values. I think I'm going to say 55.
Okay.
And just a spectacular car to get for 55 if someone could get this.
All right, JP, that's almost a week. We're going to do a show tomorrow, and then we're going to join the DWA guys on the Sierra Rewind Rally.
Yeah, you know. We're going on a DWA rally, and it's good for 3 days, and it's going to be glorious.
There's mountains over there, and we're going to drive in them. That's what we're going to do with the Radwood guys.
I brought my leather pants. Habib finished them up for me, so I'm ready to roll. Thanks for hanging out, guys. Another Bid Nerd, your daily nerd out on the most interesting cars of the day and all the automotive enthusiast auction sites. We do this Monday through Friday sometimes, mostly Monday through Thursday. And we're always live at 9:00. Make sure you go to the individual auction platforms and say that you saw these cars on Bid Nerds, and you know, let's grow the nerd herd. Let's grow the nerd nation and get more people hanging out with us. Let us know what cars you want us to review, or if you have a bid on one of the cars that we've talked about today. Let's hear it. Let's see if you're better at this than we are. You probably are. So
tomorrow we have a car, a submission, and a bid from Buddha.
Oh yeah,
on a Porsche. So we'll leave it at that.
All right,
keep it vague. Tune in tomorrow.
All right, guys. No! See you tomorrow.
Get those words!